Valuetown is a production of ChamMV TV. Find out all show information and details at chamMV.tv. Valuetown is directly supported by listeners like yourself via patreon.com/valuetown. What's up, everybody? Welcome to episode 118 of Valuetown. I'm Chan Man V, and he's Noxious. What's going on, buddy?
Not much, man. Just recovering from yesterday's beating on Firebat in the streamer show.
Oh, man. Beating a dead horse. Wow. Wow. Yeah, that was definitely a fun game. Definitely a fun episode, but wasn't nearly as competitive as the last couple episodes were.
No, definitely not. They all had the, like, in the past it seems like the scores were closer, but now I think Toast is dominating, like, for sure. Now we have like confirmation that Toast is the all-time champion.
Yeah, like we said before, we're gonna have to have him sit for maybe a week or two, get like a qualifier round, you know, a couple of them, so we can you know, have them kind of level up and then fight the boss that is Toast. But for those of you wondering what we're talking about Streamer Showdown. That was yesterday, our game show that we do maybe once, twice a month, something like that. It's been once a month lately, but we just did one yesterday with Trump, Firebat, and Disguise Toast. But this is Valuetown. So for those of you who don't know Valuetown, or maybe what we do on the show, this is a weekly podcast where we talk about Hearthstone and everything that's going on with Hearthstone, the meta, any cool decks, any events, any news going on. We just dive into it. And we take questions from you guys, too. So at the end, we'll do a Q&A, of course. And if you do have a question, go ahead and email those to valuetown@chamanv.tv, and we'll try to read them out. Usually, we receive emails before the show. So if you do it right now, there's not a very good chance that we're going to be reading it out by the end, because we already have a couple ready for the show. But yeah, the Valuetown's also, just to kind of get things out of the way, Valuetown is, of course, supported by the patron that we have, patreon.com/Valuetown. We've got lots of supporters on there, and they've been the sole supporter of Valuetown for a long time. But I want to announce that we have a sponsor for this week, which is Ting. And Ting is a U.S. cell phone provider that provides nationwide LTE access for both T-Mobile and Sprint network. And Ting does rates. So if you're one of those type of people that overpay because you don't use all your data, or you don't use all your text messages and things, Ting is all about paying for what you use. So most of the people that are having these problems, if you use Ting, you're going to cut your phone bill by at least half. And the average Ting phone bill is $23. And they're offering right now a $25 off promo that you can use now by going to valuetown.ting.com and checking out the details there. There's a description down below, or there's like an image that you can click on down below too, if you want to check that out. But big thanks to them for sponsoring this episode, as well as obviously our patrons. But it's exciting. I think this is our first sponsor that we've had for Valuetown. So, you know, yeah, kudos for Ting for that. Outside of Tempestorm. Tempestorm obviously sponsored us for a while too.
Yeah, but the show's getting it's getting big, it's getting attention. It's nice to see that after all these episodes,
yeah, making it, people are interested. Oh my god, it's amazing,
it's happening.
All right, well, anyways, let's jump on in. So another week of playing Journey to Un'Goro, or just playing all the crazy decks that are going on with the new expansion. So I figured we just kind of talk about anything that's been going on story wise, anything cool happened this week while playing it. What kind of decks have you been playing, man?
Honestly, like I've been saying, Un'Goro is the expansion to me that has revitalized Hearthstone in every possible aspect. Every class has deck that I'm interested in playing, even Warrior. I know, it's one of those things where I keep harping on, Tilt Warrior sucks. There are ways to build Warrior in a way that they're compelling, and I've actually come upon a build that I made that I thought was kind of cool. It's off the beaten path for Warrior, so this week I explored a bit more of those classes that I tend not to, and I built like a Temple Warrior with the elemental package bundled in. So it's Temple, like, old Warrior. School Temple War.
Okay. All right.
With double slam, double execute. We're Ravaging Ghoul. We're running Fireflies and a Battle Rage. so that if they get damaged by AoE later in the game, we can draw a bunch. The discovery of elementals is actually not bad. Getting blaze colors is good. Getting Tar Lords can be game winning in some stages. And I play a single copy of Sudden Genesis. Sudden Genesis.
What is that card? I don't even know that card. What is it?
Oh, it's the 5-mana spell that gives you a copy of each damage minion you've got and summons it onto the board.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So if you play sizable mid-game minions, I end up just getting copies of those. And the reason I wanted to make that deck was I realized very quickly, you know, Stonehill Defender is one of the best cards in Un'Goro.
Easy, yeah. I think everybody's starting to come to that conclusion.
Right. And I realized very quickly, well, if I run that card, you know, I can get myself some additional tots, and additional tots translate into more value, into more minions. Mm-hmm. Play Servant of Kalamos, you discover more stuff, paladin style, then warrior. And suddenly, you end up with a deck that is very different, and I end up mulliganing my quest away into a warrior half the time. I just throw it away because it's not a matchup I can play slowly. So if I'm going to mulligan my quest away, why not just play for tempo and ignore the whole quest objective and just go for pure value? So that's what sprung up. And I'm not sure, have you had any experience with, you know, the whole elemental package with Servant of Kalamos and Stonehill Defender in the same deck?
I have to say no. I haven't tried Stonehill Defender in an elemental deck at all. But to be honest, I haven't played that many elemental decks just because... just been trying to avoid it. I mean, I'm not really avoiding it. There's just been so many other things to try out that I haven't quite gotten to the just that archetype quite yet. But sounds interesting though. I mean, especially in Warrior, because obviously there are very popular Warrior archetypes that everybody's playing. So it's always good to think outside the box with, you know, just very popular classes that people are playing right now. So that tends to be something both me and you do. You know, when mid-range Shaman was super popular, we were playing the control Shamans, right? And that sort of thing.
It's funny you speak of control Shaman, because that was the other deck I was going to talk about. Volcano is a real card. Right, we all know Volcano.
Yeah, people are playing Acolyte.
Wipe the board.
People are playing Acolyte against it, right? So it's kind of funny.
But the crazy part is the card that I thought was bad that turned out to be amazing is Spirit Echo. 3-mana.
Oh yeah.
You give your minions death rattle, return them to your hand. Now, if you play that in a deck that runs White Eyes, in a deck that runs Genie Water Speaker, in a deck that runs Servant of Kalamos. It means you're getting to discover Kalamos or another big elemental, and then it comes back to your hand for another discovery. And I've just been absolutely mind-blown at how powerful Spirit Echo is in Nazoth Elemental Control Shaman. It's completely insane.
Yeah, it's not quite as good as like Reincarnate, but it has that kind of feel where you can like double up on your guys, or Faceless, you know.
On Valcries, Discover, it's insane. You get like 5 Kalamos a game. It's nuts.
It is pretty
amazing. It's insane.
No, that sounds awesome. That's definitely something I was trying to get to also. But this week I've been, you know, we're going to be spotlighting Paladin, right? So I've been playing some Paladin. Playing some of the control priests too, just because, you know, I just saw that deck floating around and I didn't quite understand how people were winning with it. Because when you look at it, you know, comparing it to like, say, the Silence Priest, the winning condition is very clear, right? You know, you get something on the board, you double the health and inner fire, or just over time, right? Over a few turns, you end up just beating them down. With a control priest, it's actually different. It's very subtle. Like the damage is just gradual. It does super well against aggro, so that's one of the reasons why it's doing so well right now. But it's not clear as to how you win. And then you realize real quickly that, Lyra gives you like amazing value. Like,
wait, you mean you don't have to play Inner Fire in your deck and you still make her 25-25? Yeah, okay, sounds good.
Yeah, so it's that card is definitely living up to the potential. But no, that card's definitely fun too. And to your point, your very first point about Un'Goro, it's been amazing so far, you know, just in terms of how many classes are viable, how many decks are floating around. And even though we see a lack of control decks, I have to say, overall though, the balance out there with, you know, just I think class usage and things looks probably the best it's looked in a year or two. So
yeah,
mission
far.
Accomplished, right? By
like,
Blizzard.
The honeymoon is still on.
Of course.
The point is, we're like pretty deep into the expansion based on the amount of time it's been out. It's like about about 2 weeks in at this point. And I feel like the Mean Streets of Gadsden honeymoon lasted 4 days.
Not even 4 hours. I mean, no, Gadgetzan. Oh, no, sorry. Gadgetzan, yes. Gadgetzan was like about a week. I'm talking about Karazhan. Karazhan was 4 hours. Yeah. It was like nothing.
Yeah, but Gadgetzan, the thing is, Gadgetzan gave us hope that there would be something undiscovered, except the only undiscovered deck with Gadgetzan, the only one, was Water Rogue. That is the deck
Water Rogue took longest
to come out with the Finja package.
Yeah.
It took a long time, but overall, the idea of, you know, oh, we're going to be playing Reno. I mean, there's only so many ways you can build a Reno deck. There's only so many ways you can build a Jade deck. And with the Un'Goro packages, what they've done is here are all these neutral packages. Stonehill Defender discovers different things in different classes. You will discover different elementals in each class. You can play this deck you're making however you want. It's been fantastic for that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And to your point with Gadgetzan too, I felt like with Gadgetzan, they built these unique elements to the expansion, and those were the strong things in the expansion. You know, like Jade was a strong thing. The dragon, dragon was a strong thing. All those things, Kazakus too, right? All those things panned out to be exactly what maybe they intended. They just wanted to make new stuff that it would end up being the strongest. With this expansion, you know, I felt like they just built more tools, not crazy specific archetypes or synergies that would force us to build the best deck. Like elementals, right? That was like the very first thing. Everybody was already in the mindset. So when the elementals were presented, everybody was like, oh, elementals, easy. Oh, that's going to be so broken. It's going to be so freaking strong. It's going to be dragons. And it hasn't been that. You know, it's strong in some decks, but it's not oppressively strong, like right from the get-go. And that's awesome.
Yeah, I feel like elementals were... I mean, one of the cool things that I like is that they've created a bunch of value cards, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of just making like high stat cards, they've created stuff like a 3-mana 1/4, that's a Silverback Patriarch, but it gets you an extra card. Or a 5-mana 4/5, that gets you an extra card. And honestly, that on its own, I think, carries it keeps the power level at bay. Like, it doesn't let it just go crazy. Sure, these cards are on average super powerful, and there are definitely outliers. And they have force-fed archetypes, like Taunt Warrior. It's clear that they're force-feeding it. But at the same time, it's not so dominant that nothing else is allowed to win. It has, you know,
it's blind beautiful
spots. Yeah. You know, you play Deadly Shot, and you're on tempo with Hunter, and suddenly the Taunt Warrior is like, well, I guess I'm dead. Because you roll over him. And there are counters, which I think is...
It's fantastic. One word, poisonous. Yeah. That works really, really well, and that's like amazing. You know, it just shows you how you know, I'm anticipating they were trying to design it that way. So that was definitely really good. I think the only surprise so far, I have to say, is that Warlock hasn't really made a giant impression outside of like Sivka's, his control lock, you know, with the dooms and everything like that, and the Medivhs. There really hasn't been any kind of good Warlock deck, which has been super surprising to a lot of folks. Not only the quest, you know, everybody's like, oh yeah, the quest is super good, but even just a regular Zoo deck. You know, we haven't even seen anything powerful. I think Murlocs have taken over that Zoo spot now. And given how well the synergy is with the Murlocs and how easy it is, you know, you don't have to make decisions about discards and juggling that sort of thing. I feel like that's just going to be the default Zoo deck. Where Warlock falls, I don't know. It might have taken an expansion before it pans out.
It lost. So that's the thing I realized is I had an arena run saved up when I was recently. I had it saved up from before the expansion. And I realized I was playing cards one at a time, and it was like, okay, let's start with Possessed Villager. All right, that's still in standard. My turn two was Dark Peddler, and I realized, you know, I was thinking, why isn't Zoo playable? Because I had the perfect curve in Arena, and I realized, wait, Zoo doesn't have Dark Peddler anymore. And then I had Arzen Horse Rider on 3, and I'm like, well, that could also fit, sort of, Ish and Zoo and other decks. And then I realized, well, that's gone too. A lot of those really good early mid-game, like to turns 1-4 that Zoo relied on, have...
Yeah, Imp Gang Boss, gone away. It's gone too, right?
Yeah, a lot of those 1-4 turns are no longer as sticky, so Zoo is having to settle for those hyper-polarized cards like Darkshire Councilman, and then if it rolls super well and you just get the snowball going, you win. But it's not consistent, and they have to hire all the right discards to get Silverware Golems and Clutch Mother. And even when they get that going, it's like, well, are you really that much better than, you know, Murloc Paladin? You know, are you doing that better?
Yeah.
And as it turns out, they're a little bit too slow.
Yeah, one thing I haven't seen yet is Murloc Warlock. You know, maybe that could be something too. But the biggest thing that they miss out on, the zoo, the demons and everything, is adapt. You know, there's nothing that makes all those minions all of a sudden better with Divine Shield or +1/+1 or Wind Fury or anything like that.
Pterodax.
Pterodax, yeah. Even poison, right? We were talking about poison now. Poison's like essential to, you know, beating down some of these taunt warriors and decks that have the big taunts. So, yeah, I think that's the one thing the zoo's lacking. You know, maybe some folks will figure out some way to navigate that, because there are some cards that are good, right? The Pterodax, like you said, the egg play, right? People still trying to make that amazing combo into crazy board control. But there are definitely holes, though, that I don't even think that high skilled, you know, high skill cap type of plays can overcome. Might take an extra expansion, maybe by summer.
Well,
it'll be super good.
I've seen some people play the Murloc build, right? Like the Murloc Warlock, as you mentioned, which I think is actually interesting that you bring it up, because I saw them play Zubat in the list with the whole, you know, Sea Devil Stinger that gives you a free Finja sometimes. You go like turn four and play a Finja for 5 health.
Oh, yeah,
In the deck, you play like Direwolf Alpha already, right? So you play the Murlocs early, you play Direwolf Alpha, and then suddenly everything, you know, kind of merges into this zoo game plan. The issue is when you don't pick up the whole Menagerie package with that deck, it's missing a bit of a push. And, you know, then you can't play the discard package in that one deck because you're too all over the place and you end up lacking focus in a way.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I definitely hear you. But I want to bring up one thing that before we kind of move on is that we did the deck of the week this past week for the patrons. This is the first one that we've ever done. And for those of you not know what we're talking about, one of the things that I started up, at least for the Patreon or the patrons that have been supporting the show, is that we bring up a deck of the week and we present a deck on the show, which we'll be doing in a little bit here. And then we have everybody play this deck, particularly the patrons. And then on Monday, we kind of get together and we do a mini show. We did audio only this time around, but we did a mini show and we had like 3 people show up and we talked about our winning percentages and, you know, some of the things that we learned from the deck and gave each other some tips as to possibly how to play the deck better. So we'll be doing that again this week. We're going to keep doing it until, you know, I feel like, you know, maybe it's not working out, but given that we got 3 folks to go, I think it, you know, definitely seems to be some interest there. And the whole point is to help you guys that don't have time to build decks and don't know how to play these decks outside of like listening to the show, just giving you just something to like some direction, you know, as to what to play. And we're going to try all kinds of different decks. Some decks will be, you know, more budget decks. Some decks will be obviously just what we talk about on the show and things like that. So we did the druid, the mana druid last time, the token druid, you know, where the aggro druid,
the living mana
druid. Exactly. And for the most part, I think the results were quite good. I think on average, outside of somebody that tweeted us today that had like an 88% win percentage, I think on average it was 60% from everybody. So,
oh yeah.
Yeah. So that's really, really good. That's crazy good. Mine was actually 58. So it wasn't quite as high.
That deck that deck got me, I think, an 18-win win streak or something. Yeah, it was ridiculous.
What?
I went all the way from like rank 10 to rank 3 with it. Like, it was absurd. I've
That's
done
crazy.
So many things with... I've tried out so many decks, and I'd say that the aggro druid is one of the most insanely well-performing ones. And I'm surprised that, you know, we don't see much talk of it. You know, people talk about Anaconda Druid. Oh, look at this deck. It's so awesome. And let's talk about Murloc Paladin. And, you know, all these decks. But Aggro Druid just seems to fly under people's radar. I don't know why, because that deck is... It's like the old school token druid, except now it says, well, if I'm out of steam, you know what? I can always just find living mana. And that's an extra tool that... It's like, think of it as the cheat card of the deck. You can beat the deck until they suddenly get that card off the top, and then you no longer can. It's like a Doom Guard off the top against Zoo when they don't have anything to lose from it. It's insane.
Well,
tempo-wise.
Yeah, exactly. And, it gives them a winning the ability to come back against aggro decks, you know, with that living mana play. Because even on, like on turn 5, right, you can fill the board for the most part. And against Warriors, against even like Murloc decks, that's all you need sometimes, because then they're going to have to start dealing with that. If you have, for whatever reason, some kind of way to combo it, if it's later in games, then you can just win games. Like you had no business winning. And I think I had maybe one or two of those games, maybe one game or two, where I had like double Power of the Wild, Power of the Wild or something like that. I never got Feral, the combo with Savage Roar, but I did get that a few times, and that ended up winning me games. So that deck is strong.
Mark of the Lotus is pretty good.
Yeah, that Mark of the Lotus too, man. That's so good. Especially with like Violet Teacher. You have like another card that combos awesome with Violet Teacher. So yeah, give that a try, guys. You can, well, obviously, if you're a patron, you can go and see the post, and you'll be able to check out just our conversation there. But this week, guys, we're going to be spotlighting the Paladin. And so what we're going to do, this is probably the first time we're doing this with Un'Goro, and we'll take a look at a class, kind of see some of the decks that are really strong right now, and then talk about the key cards. Right now, Paladin, I feel like maybe a week ago was like hipster playing, you know, Paladin and playing Tarum and doing some cool stuff with mid-range Paladin. Now it's just outright good. Like, just, you know, people are just playing it because it is definitely one of the best winning percentage decks. And I think the first thing we should start with is the aggro version of it, given that, you know, I just mentioned that it's kind of the default Zoo deck at this point. And I'm going to show a couple of them, I would say.
I don't know if it's the default Zoo deck. We've seen, like, I'd almost argue that Hunters, like some of the aggro Hunters,
yeah, that's
are
a good one too. Yeah.
Resorting to it. But yeah, basically, Murloc Paladin is real. And we're not memeing. We're not saying,
No. Yeah, I knew
Murloc Paladin. No. It's a real deck, and it has a winner rate for some people. I mean, my
super
winner rate today
high.
Must have been in the, like, 80%. It was ridiculous.
Mine's 70+, for sure, with this aggro deck. Yeah. I went from, I think, rank 10 to rank 4.
Like, oh, yeah, no doubt. In a straight line, right? No question.
Yeah, it's like 20 and 4, 20 and 5. Like, and I played a combination of these two. So the one on the left is, I think, the one that's been floating around. I think some people have seen it on Dog Stream. Some people have seen it on all kinds of people's stream. The one on the right is the one that I got. I saw VLPS developed, just, and he tweeted it out. So I wanted to give that a try, too, because it's a different take on it. But, you know, there's nothing that complicated about how this deck's built. It basically uses all the Murlocs that have some kind of synergy, you know, with other Murlocs, or it, you know, fills the board a little bit more so you can, you know, Cold Light Seer, you know, a bit better, or you can Gentle Megasaur. But it's very refined in that way. So there's no extra Murlocs. You don't throw in every single Murloc, but you throw in the ones that definitely synergize. And then the one on the left has Steward of Darkshire too, which, you know, has synergy with a lot of your Murlocs and a lot of the one drops that you have, so you can Divine Shield it. And then the Stonehill Defender, you know, we were just talking about the Stonehill Defender, best card potentially in Un'Goro. You gotta add it, especially in Paladin. Paladin has two or three taunts that the other classes don't have that are amazing, that are crazy good. You know, that includes Tyrion, it includes the 6/6 that gives you the Divine Shield, the 7 drop.
Grimstream Protector.
Yeah, Grimstream Protector. Yeah, and then I think one other one, right?
There's Wicker Flame Burn Bristle.
Yeah, Wicker Flame Burn Bristle.
And there's Sunkeeper Tareem. And
yeah.
I just want to point
Tareem.
Out.
Yeah, jeez, there's so many.
Sunkeeper Tareem is in the Murloc deck. You know, so we have like a different, there are like different aspects of the deck, right? We've got the Murlocs that are there to flood, and there are the Murlocs that are there to buff, and we have the buffers, like the complementary cards. Steward of Darkshire shields your Murlocs. Gentle Megasaur gives them a buff of your choice. Mm-hmm. And Sunkeeper Tareem, who says, big taunts are now 3/3s. My little Murlocs are now 3/3s. But cooler yet is the fact that Sunkeeper, if you have a War Leader on the board, for instance, is going to bump up the stats of your Murlocs baseline to 3/3. And the War Leader's buff will apply over it. So suddenly, if your War Leader is on the board, your 1/1 becomes a 3/3 with Sunkeeper Tareem, but then it gets a +2/+1 from Sunkeeper, the Murloc War Leader. So now it's a 5/4. And I've had a large amount of boards today that were like, so I've got all these Murlocs that are buffed up a little bit. And if I just jam Sunkeeper, I basically nullify his board and mine goes through unimpeded. And that has caused some absolute madman situations in terms of damage output. Like, I've had kills that deal 32 gentle Megasaur with Wind Fury on everything.
Yeah, those are the dreams. I mean, they don't happen very, very often.
Oh, they happened all the time.
Really? Today. They've happened like maybe one time out of the whole streak. But no question, like Tareem, you know, when you're playing, like, you know, again, those, I don't know, like Handlock or something like that, you know, which giant ass minions, and you just destroy them like very, very quickly. It's freaking amazing. And then, like you said, Megasaur has so many utilities, and that's kind of why I thought it was going to be a super strong card and potentially broken, because I knew a Murloc deck would be good. I thought it would be Shaman. I didn't actually think it would be Paladin again, but, you know, definitely Megasaur. The utility it has with, you know, poison being able to break through and continue pushing face, or the Wind Fury like you're talking about, or even just the +1/+1 has been like really, really great for me with trading against other aggro decks and things like that. It's been a huge, huge card. And I mean, we'll talk about the cards. Yeah, right? No?
That thing is so nuts.
It's so good. Like, it's crazy good.
Chart. You're like, oh, what can I do? Wait, let me gentle Megasaur 1/1 into a poisonous minion, and now suddenly they lose out everything. And that has caused, I'm sure, like degrees of frustration on the other side that are insane. But then you look at the potential outcomes and you're like, poisonous won me this game, but so could +3 attack have done it. So could Divine Shield have done it. So like, even though poisonous looked like, oh, he high rolled like mad, every option is actually pretty good on Murlocs. It seems like there's nothing wasted on them aside from maybe like a re-stealth, and sometimes even that's fine.
I would say the not targetable by hero power, you know, that whole thing, that's probably the worst one now that, you know, been able to play a lot. But poisonous, I would say half the time I'm looking for poisonous, just because, you know, against aggro you do want to trade efficiently, right? And as long as you get ahead against, I don't know, even hunters and classes like that, you'll be fine. And then of course against Taunt Warrior, it's like, oh, they just threw down, you know, the 2/7 and the, you know, just the I don't know, the 3/6s and the one, you know, the 3/5s and just all the big taunts, right, that they have. And you're just like, oh, I just throw my 1/1s like into each one, and you just, and they're
the
all
cool
gone.
Thing is that the Ali Armorsmith, the 2/7
yeah,
for warriors that they taunt up with, if your guys have Divine Shield, it doesn't gain the warrior any armor because it doesn't deal any damage.
Yep,
and that has been also a game winner for me in many of those matchups. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of nuance to the way to play the deck. I feel like it looks super straightforward, but then like the proper way to play it is not to just vomit anything on curve. Mm-hmm. And that's proven to be like an interesting balance to strike. It's been very, very interesting to play.
Yeah, well, why don't we look at a few of the key cards here, and let me just move at least one of these over to the side here, and we'll bring up some of the cards. So Megasaur I just talked about. Hydrologist, I think Hydrologist is, I know a lot of people are high on Hydrologist, and it was probably the card I would say I most underrated was Hydrologist, because, you know, like at first glance the secrets are just not that great. You know, when you're just thinking about secrets in any situation, but in the situation of this type of Zoo Murloc deck, it's super good. Like almost all of those secrets are really, really good, with exception to Eye for an Eye and maybe one other one.
I've won three Freeze Mage games today to Eye for an Eye, because the only way you beat them, the literal only way to beat them, is to force them to die to themselves by throwing a spell in your face. Otherwise, you just can't do it.
Right.
So Eye for an Eye on mages has been exceptional, since they're all running a burn package, it feels.
But you get hit by it first, right? The damage actually is taken off by you. And so have you had draws?
I was on the verge of a draw, but the mage was smart enough to wait until he was at his last card and picked up Alex.
Right.
He didn't attack or play anything. That's the one game I wish I could have just gotten, you know, a stealth Murloc like Finja at the right time, or a Bluegill, which the deck we're talking about, the primary deck, does not run. And had it been for Bluegill, I would have won that game. But, you know, probably on average. But because the first list we're talking about plays like Zoo, it doesn't run, you know, an understated 2-drop.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like it's got room for that. And I kind of get it.
Yeah. But, man, secrets like Noble Sacrifice, great for tempo. Redemption, I think, has been one of the best ones that I've been using. Even the Kodo one, you know, the one that actually returns it to your hand. Oh my god, it's been so great with you know, Stonehill Defender and any of the taunts. So the secrets are really, really good. And obviously, this being a Murloc too has synergy with it. Yeah, this card has been phenomenal in this deck and like essential. You can't not have it. And given that there's not the greatest card draw here outside of small time recruits, which I guess I can move over here. And this is kind of an interesting approach too, right? Because everybody in the beginning and by default always thinks Divine Favor. But it turns out that small time recruits is better in this situation, given that you run so many one drops and you're guaranteed to draw three. So for a long time, I was like, man, Valen got screwed. Small time buck versus this is ridiculous. Like, not even close. This small time's terrible compared to the one that Warrior got. But we're finally finding a place for it. And, you know, it comes at a timely moment. You never keep this card, obviously. You want to, like, draw into this card. But, yeah, I think it's been interesting how they used it. Do you prefer this card over Favor or no?
So I'll say it's matchup dependent, right? So it's all going to be based on what you face off against. Sure. I think that's what's going to matter the most. But what I've considered doing is I've considered cutting down to one draw engine. You know, like I've considered slowing down the deck a bit to where instead of playing completely like Zoo, it finds room for two server champions because they're not in the core list we're talking about. I feel like having a big buff like a Blessing of Kings is often better than going wide on the board. I feel like that would help me out in many matchups, and you know, maybe finding room for just a Tyrion baseline in the deck, right? Like maybe find a slot for that.
Yeah,
and I'm not sure how I would go about modifying the list, but I feel like that would make the consistency of the deck increase. Like playing Grimmscale Oracles, you know, one mana 1/1s that give plus one. Like that's cute and all, and it's nice, but I feel like sometimes that card is better, would be better off as a weapon or as a late game card or as a, you know, Blessing of Kings. And that's where I get a bit hesitant about the current versions we're running with. But overall, I'd say Favor has been, to me, more consistent than just small time recruits, I think, for late game pushes, because you rarely win on turn 4 or 5. Mm-hmm. It's really like long drawn out games.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that too. In my recent modification, I did drop one small time recruit, and like you said, Grimmscale Oracle, I think, is the first thing that you can drop from this list. Given that I felt like I'm always looking for Tyrion, you know, that why not just add a Tyrion to your freaking deck?
Right.
You know, instead of Stonehilling for a Tyrion, it's like, just add one, you know, and it's probably going to do a lot better than the plus one that I'm going to get on a lot of these Murlocs for trades and things like that. So, yeah, Tyrion's been added to mine based on that. But we'll be talking about a mid-range in a second. So, obviously, Tyrion will be part of that deck. But yeah, so I mean, aggressively, I think this deck is fairly easy to play too. I would say you do have to prep, you know, like you do have to control your resources a bit, and turn one, I have to say, is probably one of the most important plays. Like,
it's silly, right?
Yeah. It's like, which one do I play? You know, it's like, do I play the Tidecaller? Do I play the Inquisitor? Do I play Grimmscale? Of course, obviously don't play the Chum versus anything that can ping you, but, you know, even just coining out, like when you have the coin, especially, do I play the Hydrologist? Do I play the Murlocs that only have one health? You know, so it's interesting to figure out what the right play is against your matchup.
Yeah, the coin is where this deck is really blurry, because Rockpool Hunter is great as a follow up to anything. It buffs a Murloc by +1/+1. So if you can play a Murloc on one and play him on two, you can coin out Hydrologist, get this guy out. It's fantastic. But then there's these matchups where, you know, against Hunter, you're like, well, Hyena is a thing. I can't just play something into Hyena and lose the game. So how do I stall these alley cats without feeding the Hyena too much?
Yeah.
And oftentimes you end up slowing down way too much and fall behind until you suddenly get a mid-game pushback with like a Stonehill Defender buys you a single turn, and then there we go, Megasaur, Venja. And everything. It's been tough.
Yeah,
tough-ish aggro deck to play.
Yeah, definitely. It's really good against Warrior too. I've had a lot of success against aggro Warrior. Probably a little bit less success against Taunt, but still generally good whenever I can get that poison. It all depends on the gentle Megasaur draws for that matchup. With the other Zoo deck, the VLPS one that I had here. Let me show that one real quick. So this was a little bit different because it has Argent Squires and Firefly. It basically has four cards in the one drop. And this is the kind of this is the kind of deck that you want small time recruits over Divine Favor, because there's like 10 one drops, so you're not going to miss with it. This is going to do well. This is going to do better against aggro decks, just because you'll be able to outpace and most of the time trade better against them. I would say it's better against Hunter too. You know, it's just the same principle, but it's a lot worse against the slower ones, is what I've found. Yeah. You can still win like a ton. So it's
right. It's down to Argent. The thing is, like, Argent Squire's in here instead of Grimmscale Oracle, and Firefly's in here instead of the
Stonehills.
The stone, mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So you don't get the like late game Tyrion pushes and whatnot. However, it gives you a lot of consistency in the early stages of the game, where like Firefly and Argent Squire work in a similar fashion, right? Like, if you're gonna play Argent Squire, you're gonna play Firefly before you do that. So when you see that they have like four, you know, two Fireflies, two Squires, this means they're really valuing the early game pings. They want to compete with the pirates that are out there. They want to compete with the weapons that often come out. Because one notorious thing I've noticed about the deck is, you know, your turn two plays with Bilefin Tidehunter and Murloc Tidehunter, those are really weak to pirates. Like Grimmscale Chum turn one, I mean, I just don't want to do that. It just hurts. Mm-hmm. So that's the reason I think why we're seeing more Argent Squires, Fireflies in this list as a more anti-aggro tech.
Yeah, if you're playing against a lot of warriors, this deck is the one to go to versus the other one. It's got Bluegill Warrior too. You know, Bluegill Warriors is huge for trading or even just pushing faves at the very last minute too. So yeah, definitely check this version out. Again, VLPS I think tweeted this well. He might have revised it since then, but I had a lot of success with this too. I think when I first played this, I was 6-1 or 7-1 or something like that. So I think generally you can't miss with aggro Murloc Paladin right now. But why don't we talk about a more of a mid-range type of deck here. Okay, let me take some of these cards off of here.
Right, so mid-range Paladin is kind of interesting because since the expansion came out, there's been a trend where you know, people are looking for decks, right? And people have been experimenting with a way to construct a deck that would be mid-range Paladin, harkening back to the days of Quartermaster and, you know, those slower days. And as it turns out, right now there's no like pure control Paladin, because the mid-range decks have the luxury of including the cards that we'd normally call, you know, control cards. So what usually qualifies a deck right now to become a control deck is when you're running double Equality, double Wild Pyro, and double Doomsayer. Like, that is the only thing. If you have these six cards, you're probably a control Paladin. Everything else is, like, honestly just a Paladin deck that's going through the mid-range. And so there's different ways to build them. But as I was saying earlier, you know, we have a lot of neutral cards that have Discovery slapped onto them. You know, people tried mid-range Elemental with the Servant of Kalimos to discover Ragnaros Lightlord. Mm-hmm. And people tried that approach as well with the Stonehill Defenders slapped on top. But then people gravitated towards another value, and I think Tides was the first to do that, where he went for the, well, not the first, but definitely one of the first, went for the Primal Fin Lookout. You know, drop the Elemental package, no Ragnaros Lightlord discovered from Servant of Kalimos.
Yeah.
And instead, we're going to try to play Vilefin Inquisitor, create Murlocs on a whim to then trigger Primal Fin Lookout and get ourselves an extra Murloc. And that was interesting to me. I was kind of interested to see that people got creative with value plays.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big thing. It's just figuring out that you can fit in value plays at the end of games instead of building an entire deck around value plays like, you know, we've seen in the past, where you have to just fully commit to that. And that's why Stonehill Defender is just so great. It's sometimes you just need one extra card, and that's enough for you to end up winning a game. But yeah, so this deck is quite different than the previous one. It still does have a very big Murloc base, just to kind of facilitate that early game. You can even think of it sometimes in terms of it being removal, like against Hunter. Like, you just need those minions on the board to do something about just the pressure that they put, because you don't want to rely on having to draw quality all the time and that sort of thing. And then Stampede and Kodo, I think that's performed really well too. I've seen people play one, I've seen people play two, trying it out. And then Spiked Rich Steed, I think that's another the main new cards that we've been seeing. Defensively, it's great. it requires you to, you know, have something on the board. If you don't know what the card is, it's I'll show it to you real quick. It's a buff that's 6 mana +2/+6 and taunt, and then when it dies, it gives you a 2/6 Stegodon that you can play later. So this was really, really good if you can keep some minions on the board. And generally with Paladin and a lot of these Murlocs, you can't at least keep one. So I think you can only, I think playing one is probably the best. Playing two is pretty tough. You get in this situational things and it can be, you know, it can be a dead card in your hand if you have nothing on the board.
Yeah, so. But it seems to work out for people. Like we've had a bunch of like Paladin has actually been rank one legend repeatedly is the point.
Oh, yeah.
Like, we've had a lot of people cycling in and out. Mm-hmm. What I would be inclined to do with the mid-range Paladin is really just keep the aggro early Murloc, you know, setup. I would be inclined to keep that stuff and then jam some late game, like maybe one Steed. Playing Curator with one Stampeding Kodo seems amazing to me. You know, you get Kodo or Gentle Megasaur, and you get a Murloc on top. And you know, while you're at it, why not do like a lot of people have been doing and play Primordial Drake? Because why not? So, like, the difference between a mid-range deck and an aggro deck is kind of subtle in that you're cutting some early game cards to then jam Aldor Peacekeepers and Spike Ridge Steeds and Ragnaros Lightlord. Mm-hmm. But the differences aren't all that massive. Like, they're not like, we're changing 15 cards. No, we're keeping that Murloc package, man. Like, that Murloc package is sweet, and we want to keep it. And, you know, do we play... So, Blessing of Kings would be better in an aggro deck, and Spike Ridge Steed is better in a slower mid-range deck. You know, that's what I've been finding, and it's kind of cool to see the differences there in builds.
I mean, you can think of it like this. There's no small-time recruits or divine favor here. So there has to be some kind of drawing mechanic, and the drawing mechanic is Curator, you know, and it draws into late game things, you know, value type of cards. So it's very synergistic with how the deck's built, and it's built in a very cool way too. You know, these are the type of deck building, I guess, schemes or what you can say are that take a lot of playing and really figuring out, okay, what's needed once we start with this kind of base. And how do we, you know, extend, you know, just the success or the win percentage of this base, which is, you know, the Murloc, right? And it probably started as an aggro Murloc, and slowly, you know, one card at a time, you know, 10 cards got changed to make it more of a mid-range deck. And that's really, really cool.
I think I don't like Ragnaros Lightlord.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing.
I'd say, like, if I wanted to cut something here, I'd probably cut, like, one Spike Ridge Steed and the Ragnaros to make room for Blessings of Kings or something. Like, you know, some really beefy buff, because I've got so much early game. That feels like fits the what the deck wants to do, and I like that.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think I was watching Tyler play. I think he was coming to that conclusion with Lightlord too. He was thinking about dropping it last night. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think those two would be good. I think you have a lot of options as to what you want to do with those two cards, but it all depends on what you get from Stonehill Defender, to be honest. If you get the right cards with Stonehill Defender, then, you know, you can add anything and you're good. But maybe Vine Cleaver, you know, that's one of the things Savitz does here on the right, with Vine Cleaver.
I love that. Yeah.
And then that guarantees that you're going to have, you know, the two minions, right, for Nesting Rock. Nesting Rock is like another defensive, it's situational too, kind of like Spike Steed, but it's situational a different way, right? So
it can come out of Curator, which is a big deal.
Yeah, that too. Yeah.
It's like, do you play this or Kodo? Mm-hmm. That's the big question. And oftentimes, as it turns out, Nesting Rock against some of the more beefy minions is better, like against Warrior, for instance, that might not have, you know, in the later stages of the game when you've got 1/1s on the board. Sometimes Nesting Rock's a bit tougher to Kodo is tougher to make work than Nesting Rock. One of the things that I ran into earlier, though, and you'll probably be happy to hear that, Chen, man, is I was playing this deck, like not this list, but an aggro Murloc, and I got completely raffle stomped by a Volcano Shaman with double Hex, double Devolve, double Lightning Storm, double Mail. Anyway, just all the doubles, and with Spirit Echo, so I couldn't, like, the Genie Water Speaker was on the board. I can't kill it, so I can't take a value trade because it just heals up. And I just got Raffle Stomped. No question. Just completely Raffle Stomped. I played Megasaur twice, and twice I got devolved into Wisps. I went,
really?
Megasaur, yeah, let's get Divine Shield.
Nice.
And I felt bad. But
yeah, I haven't gotten a chance to really delve into control shaman. I started playing like a Stonehill shaman just to, you know, just to see if I could get, how often I could get wide eyes and things like that. But, you know, I didn't get a chance to see Volcano. I've heard Volcano's good. I've heard, I've even seen people start playing Acolyte to counter even potential Volcanoes out there. So somebody's playing control shaman out there, because there's no way that Volcano is played for me outside of that. But that's definitely a good thing. I feel like that and Meteor have been very surprising as to how triggering those cards have been for people.
It's insane, right? It's got it, like, some people get so frustrated with some of the RNG that happens, but Hearthstone. No, that's what you live for.
Yeah.
I've still got, you know, honestly, I still have some gripes. And I mean, like, massive gripes.
For what?
Swashburglar.
Oh,
like, that card just does not feel okay. Like, I lost two games today to Swashburglar again that were on lockdown. And then the guy gets Wicker Flame Burn Bristle off of Swashburglar. And that's the point. I'm just like, well, look, you know, he with the Quest Rogue, right?
Yeah.
Quest Rogue, she's at seven, like, wait, six health. And I'm about to deliver lethal. And she goes, Wicker Flame. It's now 5/5 with Divine Shield Taunt and Double Heal. I'm just like, okay, I guess we're done here.
That's going to happen, like, man.
I know, but I don't like that they roll so many burglars, because I'm just waiting for the BlizzCon. Like, I'm just waiting for BlizzCon. I want to see whether or not we have another one of those.
No, of course we will.
Laugh at Swashburglar because finals were determined on 1 out of 25. Like, no, that's just, ugh.
It's, you know, it's funny because I think that the Swashburglar play isn't going to feel as bad as the Babbling Book, because a lot of times, well, I don't know, maybe it will, but a lot of times with the Swashburglar, like, I see with Quest Rogue, you know, the impact is early, you know, like super fast. So the games don't last that long anyways. So, and I think with shorter games, people don't think as much about it as, you know, this 25 turn, 30 turn game that Babbling Book brings up, you know, the right card and you're just screwed, you know, that sort of thing. But it's bound to happen. I mean, there's too many cards, there's too many Cabal's Tomes and Babbling Books and Swashburglars at this point that, you know, it's got to have some random aspect to it.
Well, I mean, the thing is, I'm pretty sure people will eventually just, if the game is quick, right, and the rogue's about to die, and she goes, Swashburglar, Wicker Flame, like, that's going to...
Yeah, that's huge. I mean, you have to crash two things. That buys them a turn, and a turn against Quest Rogue is huge.
Yeah, so I don't know. I'm hoping there's no such memes or memery in important matches and important games within those matches.
Yeah.
Know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I totally know what you mean. Yeah. Okay. Well, I don't think we have any you know, again, like you just mentioned, there's not real, like, a huge control paladin floating out there outside of maybe the Holy Wrath one, which I guess you could call is control up until the OTK play. But I think there's potential for some out there. It's just mid-range and aggro are just such good options right now. It's hard to you know, play anything else other than that. And it kind of has the shaman syndrome. You know, control shaman was never that bad, but it's never going to be played because mid-range shaman is so damn good and aggro shaman were so damn good. I think paladin's having the same thing right now.
But I think control shaman might become a legit tech for tournaments right now. Like, that deck is... I will make that statement. I think Control Shaman is the best deck to beat the Paladin Murloc spam. I think it is by far the best deck for that.
Yeah.
Maybe Freeze Mage. Maybe Freeze Mage is actually better against it. But Freeze Mage might be, you know, even better. But that deck, just double devolve on a Megazord board, is just so crushing. Hex on the Tyrians, they're discovered. They've just got it, man. Like, Shamans have it this time. Like, they've got a good control deck that feels super sturdy. And it's got the ability, if you play Nazoth, to also outvalue control decks. If you play Igneous Elementals with Tauren and White Eyes, you know, that's enough to come back. So it's been good.
Okay, well, I'm going to have to try that out soon. I have this crazy infatuation with Control Shaman for some reason. And I can't even explain it, but there is some type of desire for Control Shaman to be good in the metagame. But okay, Oh, go ahead.
One note before you shut us out of this topic. If you guys want a gorgeous golden card, make Volcano, like, now.
Oh, it is. It's really nice.
You have to, like, playing it golden and then seeing the animation happen is just one of the most satisfying board clears that I've ever seen. It is so satisfying seeing your opponent's board just fall apart. And yeah, looks good.
I have to say that just the general animations in Goro have been really good.
That's true. That's
There's a
good
lot
point.
They, of little things.
They've really been kicked up a notch, but I thought of all the ones that Volcano deserved the most, the most love.
All right, well, why don't we kind of transition into just the shout-outs that we always do for iTunes and the folks that have been leaving five-star reviews for us and nice comments. For those of you that do listen to Valuetown on iTunes or Google Podcasts, anything audio, sound, SoundCloud, leave us a review. You know, wherever platform you use, leave us a review, five-star review if you like the show. It really helps with folks trying to find Valuetown in terms of when they type Hearthstone, you know, just SEO and things like that. But I do want to give a shout out to Pum Daddy, Virtual Royalty, Scommer, Angry Avocado for being the latest folks to do that. And we've been getting a lot recently. So, man, thanks to all of you guys for doing that. It's amazing. It wasn't too long ago that we had like 40 of them, you know, and now we have like almost 140 of them. So it's been really, really great that you guys have come out. And also want to plug some of the patrons. Again, the show is supported by the folks, all of you folks that have been contributing to the Patreon at patreon.com/Valuetown. Big thanks to Mike T, Richard S, of course, our legendary producers, as well as Esser G, William C, Gary D, Joel A, Jonathan V, Michael O, William S, Drunken Monk, and Cody K. And again, guys, if you want to keep the show going and want to, just us being able to grow the show and do some cool things, think about contributing even just a little bit, like a quarter, 50 cents, a dollar, whatever. The way it's set up is it's X number of dollars per episode. So if you can, that'd be amazing and would help us greatly. Like even like 50 cents, you don't understand like how much it helps us. And also, guys, I want to talk about the deck of the week. So we mentioned the deck of the week earlier. I think the deck of the week, given that we're doing Paladin, originally I wanted to do Hunter, but given that we're doing Paladin this week, I think we should just do Paladin, a Paladin deck here. And why don't we just go with the very, very fast one here that we talked about on the show. And I think it's a good baseline. And you guys can get a feel for it too. And go ahead and start playing that. What we'll do on Monday is we'll get into Discord. There's a specific channel that we get into. And we just have at it with talking about it. I produced this like mini episode that we'll be able to distribute to folks. Right now I'm just distributing it to the patrons, given that this is like a patron only type of thing, but we'll see how well it does. If it does even better, then maybe we expand it out even more. Lastly, we got we're sponsored again by Ting, so we got a quick video from Ting which you might enjoy here. So we'll be right back. Can we just talk about how cool that video is? Have you ever played Sprint, that video game, arcade game?
I did not watch Sprint. No, I did not play Sprint. That is too young.
Yeah, you must be too young. I used to spend so many quarters on that game. And those of you wondering what the hell I'm talking about, there's this arcade game that's called Sprint that's driving. That video is totally, like, I guess, designed to look like it. And I mean, even the track is exactly the same as the very first track. And it was like one of those games where you have four steering wheels, like all standing steering wheels, all next to each other. And I think it was one of the first games where you could get nitro boosts, and there's like shortcuts on the things. Yeah, dude, it was fun. Look that up if you ever guys go to any kind of vintage arcades. But I always get a laugh out of that. But yeah, anyways, check out valuetown.ting.com if you want to find out some more about Ting and what they do, and if it ends up cutting your phone bill in half. Okay, next up, we're going to talk about events. So we obviously have the global games going on right now. In fact, we had a hard time getting a guest because like literally everybody is playing today. US, UK, Netherlands, like literally everybody is playing right now. So it was hard to get folks. It's great, this event having all of our favorite players and personality, some personalities too playing, is wonderful. Have you gotten a chance to watch any of the global games recently?
I've watched the one that we had, Bulgaria versus Brazil, I believe. I watched the entire series.
Oh yeah,
I've been quite enjoying the speed of the matches. I don't know what it is about the format, but I feel like strategies gets executed very quickly. There's no it doesn't drag on forever. Like, no longer Resident Sleeper matches with Warrior versus Warrior armor games until fatigue. And yeah. for all the hatred I have for, you know, the removal of those mechanics, for tournament watchability, it definitely does a lot, right? Like, we can't deny that fatigue games in tournaments were some of the most grueling. And the thing is, when you're watching a tournament, you're watching a marathon of games. And I think Global Games is one of the first few tournaments that I can sit and watch the entire thing in a reasonable time frame. Like, there's not going to be that ridiculously long matchup. And, you know, I've been liking quite a bit of that, honestly. I like the bantering between the casters. I've just been liking the entire thing so far.
Yeah, the casters have done great. I think overall, I agree with you. I think the speed of the matches have been, you know, something that you can kind of watch in the background just all day and, you know, kind of like catch it and, you know, definitely really, you know, you get a sense for what the meta is right now, you know, and what the top players are playing and how they're interacting with each other. I'd say the only criticism that I have for the event is that it doesn't seem any more special than any other event. And, you know, like, I feel like what they kind of accomplish with the team, I mean, we can't actually hear the team speaking, you know, and like talking to each other. So it just
they speak in different languages, right? Which is the problem. Is like, you know, Bulgaria speaking on the mic wouldn't be something. Like, I mean, you could broadcast it, but
it'd be amazing. Had to get subtitles and everything on there. And,
I mean, that would be great if they just had like live subs going on and everything. But the issue I've got is when I watch the HGG, I feel like there's a huge skill gap between countries.
Oh, okay.
You know, like some countries are clearly not, like, their team is clearly not on the level of that of other countries. And I'm not sure if it's like, you know, I have
it's
to wonder,
okay,
like,
are if that's these, the case. It's fine.
It's fine, but that's my question is, like, are these the best people in those countries? Or are they the people who got voted up the most? Or are they the only players in that country? Yeah, that's what I'm trying to figure out. I know that they mostly have other players than what's shown on the roster, but they're, you know,
the captains are the best, right? Because they're measured by HCT points.
Well, yeah, well, sure, we'll use that measure for the most part. That's true. It's not completely, it's not perfect. It's not a perfect system.
Not perfect.
It is not a perfect system when you have a carryover from last year. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's been really good to see, you know, the just generally speaking, people experimenting and coming at the metagame with different angles. Funny enough, you know, Quest Rogue is everywhere in the tournament. And
yeah, it is. Every time I look,
if you watch it being played, it's actually not just a straightforward all-in play that we see on ladder. You know, people are not playing Dirty Rat on turn two in Control Warrior. You know, like, these decks are actually played by people who have come up with the list. And you can tell there's a huge difference.
We didn't even talk about Dirty. Can we talk about how good Dirty Rat has been in given situations? I mean, it's been amazing. We actually have a question from a viewer that we'll bring up a little bit later pertaining to Dirty Rat. But I've seen so many epic Dirty Rat plays in competition recently since Un'Goro came out. It's really, really great. Because there was that question whether it would be played versus the other 2-6. And I think right now everybody's been playing Dirty Rat.
Yeah, Dirty Rat is just about everywhere, right? Like, it denies Quest Rogue's bouncing shenanigans. Mm-hmm. It messes up Freeze Mage sometimes.
Bad.
Not there.
It messes
you've
up
gotta,
badly.
Like, if you get an Arcanologist early, sometimes you're just crap out of luck for the second Ice Block, and that wins games in and of itself. So that's been quite nice to see.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've been liking that.
Okay, so overall, I think the Global Games, you know, it's been good. You know, I don't think there's been any hitches lately. I think it's been pretty much on schedule. It's going on for the next 6-7 weeks. And, of course, it happens during the time of the show, so that's not very great for us. But, you know, that's just kind of how it is. Hopefully, we'll see. I forget when the group rounds actually end. I think once the group rounds end and then we start seeing, you know, some of the plans. Yeah, I know. So,
and then we've got a reset of that too, right?
Yeah, I think there's another group of after that, right? So, it's going to be a while. It's pretty long. I have to say, it's very, very long. But for all the players involved, it's definitely great. Okay, well, another event that happened was the team brawl, the Red Bull team brawl that we've seen in the past, where it's sealed. It's a sealed format. They have teams of three compete against each other. I think they have four teams of three, And the way they do it is that they have, I forget how many packs that they that you get to open using the Tempest Storm sealed tool or sealed deck tool that you can set up, customize yourself. And you build three decks, and then they basically play a series, you know, just a conquest series, right? With the three decks. And, you know, I think we had, what, Tempest Storm, Luminosity, Toast had his own team, and then we had an arena team that was like Hafu and Merps and Edwukta. So that's the first time we actually had an arena-only team. So I felt like that was interesting. But they kept emphasizing that the arena players would have more of an advantage than the, you know, normal standard players. But I didn't think that was the case. I was like, this is more like standard than this is
arena. They got RNG'd hard. Like, I watched them go off, dude. Like, they just got the worst end of the RNG. Whatever games I watched, it was just like, damn, like, these arena guys just got screwed on every flip that could have possibly happened. I don't know how much it had to do, you know, with the end result, but it, like, because of the amount of packs you open, sure, it's like Arena, but it's also more like Constructed because you do have a say in synergy, which Arena doesn't draft around very much, right? Like, it's not to say you don't, but the more cards you unlock, the more likely it is that your Constructed skill becomes important. And there's a reason why in Magic, playing draft, playing sealed, and playing Constructed are three different skill sets. Mm-hmm. And sure, we call Limited the combination of, you know, drafting and sealed, but you open so many more cards on sealed than draft that it's just, it's a very different universe you live in. And, you know, you don't use the same skill set. Arena is very limited. You don't have, like, if Arena gave you an overhead of 15 cards, if it said you draft 45 and then you get to pick 30 to make a deck, mm-hmm. I'd say, sure, that gives you an advantage in sealed because that's effectively being able to trim out the stuff you don't want and narrow down to one strategy you're looking for. But on the way that Arena works, based on the way Arena works in Hearthstone, I feel like the Constructed advantage is just as good as the Arena advantage at the end of the day. So
I actually think the Constructed one is, they just had an advantage over the Arena folks for all the things that you said. You know, when you're looking at 120 cards and you get to build, you know, three decks or something like that, that is way different than having to draft one at a time sequentially, you know, not knowing what you're going to be drafting in the future. So it was an interesting element. We definitely did see just the playing skills of the arena players coming out. And that was probably one of the more interesting aspects of it, them talking about plays. You could just feel the arena type of frame of mind playing into what is more of a standard type of format. So that was actually great to see. And it just shows you those guys, they could just play standard. Like, they just had to practice different decks. You know, they just, we've seen Hafu like get to legend, I don't know how many seasons in a row just by doing that. So that's nothing new that we didn't know, but it's definitely cool getting a chance to see them though. I think overall with the, well, for those of you that didn't get a chance to see it, spoilers, Toast's team that consists of him, Kibler and Sidonia, like, I don't even know how these people are, like, matched up. Kibler and Toast, okay, I get that. The Sidonia come from somewhere. It's just like, okay.
TSM, boy, get somebody, get a good player on, why not?
That's player. Pretty much.
He's not had much public exposure, but he's a solid guy.
No, he's been on the show, like, obviously, a couple times, even semi-recently, so it was kind of a cool mix. They ended up winning, so, you know, chalk one up for Toast again. He's just, like, winning everything in the stage streamer showdown and a team brawl and all that good stuff. But the event, somebody's saying in the chat that they didn't promote it very well. Yeah, I think they didn't. Yeah, they probably just didn't promote it that much. I think there were a lot of people that didn't see it. They still got a very good number of viewers. So, you know, overall, the event was produced really well. I mean, it felt like Trinity, you know, like maybe the finals of Trinity, where you had the three people sitting there and talking and, you know, going into the team chats from time to time, and some classic moments too when they went in the team chat. And, you know, even with the casters, right, they were in like a movie theater, you know, so it had that kind of feel for that sort of a casual approach. So I think that was cool. I wish this would have been a pre-recorded event, so that they would have been able to highlight the drafting, because the drafting was done on the individual stream. So I completely missed the drafting. And I felt like that was a huge part of what makes this format unique. And then, you know, the whole math moment, right, that we had in the previous ones, right? The epic ones where they're looking over each other's shoulders and playing at the same time. I kind of like that too. You know, like that part of the event I think was missing from the past. They opted to go with a more refined type of production, which I don't blame them. I mean, I understand why they did it, but the kind of character that I loved about the first one and the second one too, but mostly the first one, I felt like wasn't in this one. And
that's largely because of, you know, the drafting not being as obvious. Because mm-hmm. one of the things about draft, like, I have this thing where if I play Magic the Gathering, for instance, for drafting purposes, or even mm-hmm. Arena and Hearthstone, sometimes I just draft the deck, and then I see the play button, and I'm like, I don't actually want to play this deck. I just right. want to draft
That's
more.
Right.
I don't know how many people have that problem, but like, I just want to see cards come up and have to make.
I do it in Hearthbone. I do it on the right. tool, right? In Hearthbone.
Well, there you go, man. So I do that so much that at some point when I see that the draft is not like the huge portion of the stream, I think it takes away some of the soul of the event. That being said, Sealed is still by far my favorite format in Hearthstone mm-hmm. as of right now.
Great.
The fact that they're combining teams and Sealed is really nice. Again, expanding the types of formats we have in Hearthstone is really important. And we had one of the developers recently speak on that topic. You know, what does Blizzard plan to do to support team leagues and whatnot? You know, what do they plan to do with formats? And one of the points they made that was interesting was the community is largely responsible for how esports is being shaped up in Hearthstone. Mm-hmm. Even as early as the beta phase of Hearthstone, we had nothing to do with esports. The community kind of took esports and ran with it. And so Blizzard played up until this point a huge catch-up game, right? They've been catching up to what people wanted, but they're finally, you know, coming to the point where they have infrastructure, they have people in place, and we might see stuff like formalized team leagues that is being added to the game, in competitive scene, and stuff like Sealed might at some point be discussed. And if that were the case, then what an achievement that would be for the whole of Tempo Storm's efforts on that front. I would be very happy if Blizzard supported that format.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And those of you wondering what we're talking about with, you know, Sealed and the Tempo Storm, you know, Code Phobia has been, and, you know, just a group of developers have been working on the Sealed tool for a long time. And their first iteration was the one that was, you build three decks. I forget exactly what the number of packs it was, but it was very rigid. Like, you could only play that format because it was literally built for the first Red Bull Team Brawl.
Right, Team Brawl.
Now, you know, and, you know, one of the things that he had me do is just take a look at it before the actual event. They've released it and they've added the customization aspect of it. So now you can pick, you know, how many decks you want to build, how many packs you want from this expansion. You can customize it as, you know, as how you like, you know, and then you can actually go through the Sealed where it just opens packs for you. So the tool is actually pretty sophisticated, and it's great. You know, I think there should be more tools that people need to build. And, you know, I was actually in the process of doing some. I've just been so busy with some of the other stuff I've been doing recently, but I wanted to do some more of those showdowns, you know, the Valiton showdowns. And there's actually, you know, there was a tool that I was working with somebody to build that had different types of formats, very similar, you know, similar to Sealed, how that is, like how you build decks. Yeah. Like, there's different ways to build decks that are super fun that folks can build, and we can actually do even more of these type of events like Team Brawl. So the potential is there. I mean, it's like the tip of the iceberg. Like, that, I wish there were more event organizers that would do different things with these events instead of just the same competitive type events. Because where you need to focus, guys, and I'll just throw it out there, is how the decks are built. That is right. Where the fun aspect of Hearthstone event organizing comes from. It's not in the playing. The playing aspect of Hearthstone is something we've seen a million times already. It's almost like something you just kind of have to do. It's just a necessity. But the part that's unique and where you can change is how the decks are built. And Sealed does that. Sealed is a one option. There are many other options. Like, I can think of five off the top of my head right now that would be super fun to do. And, you know, we just need more organizers, I think, to do some of those things.
And again, a lot of organizers, despite that goodwill, they run into hiccups with Hearthstone production because they don't realize how heavy it is. Like, they don't realize how much effort you need to pull off a Hearthstone stream that looks good. It is difficult to get even just the scenes properly arranged. So I understand where you're coming from, but I think some of them have wanted to do that and have simply run into logistics issues where they just don't have people who have the know-how. Because here's one of the things that I realized from working as a caster. Sometimes you get to see behind the scenes a little bit. And not every production team is created equal. And not all of them have a similar and as accurate understanding of what a Hearthstone stream should look like and contain. And it means that Hearthstone, despite looking easy to get into, because it looks easy, it's just this childish card game with cartoons, haha, how hard can it be to produce, lol. They have a spectator mode, that's got to be easy. No, that spectator mode is incomplete, and you have to do more to make it look good. And like, capturing deck building requires so many more bits of input that at the end of the day, most organizers don't even have the people to do that. They don't even have someone they can ask, hey, do you know how to do this, and can you pull it off? They don't even have that. So they end up having to outsource, and that costs a ton, and then suddenly problems arise.
No question that this type of thing should be edited. Like, it should be pre-recorded and edited for optimal, you know, just for it to be shown in an optimal way. But, you know, when it comes to producing, like, these streams, they're proven concepts already. I mean, this isn't like back when I was doing Deck Wars, dude. I mean, this is you know, we're discovering it for the first time. This is not that anymore. Everybody's come up, like, everybody knows how to produce just regular competitive events very efficiently with, you know, dynamic overlays, everything like that, right? There are people that make those things at this point. So, you know, when you're adding new elements, sure, that's something to learn and try to figure out. But having the ability to edit, it gives you so much freedom, you know, to... you choose what to do, you know, kind of direct, right? Figure out what you want to show. And I think there's a lot of potential there. I don't feel like we've done enough of that type of content yet. And, you know, obviously I'm trying to do it with Streamer Showdown, but I'm talking about even just more competitive stuff. You know,
Hearthstone.
Yeah. Actual Hearthstone types of formats that we haven't even touched it. So, I don't know, just throwing that out there. I think Team Brawl, again, I think it was a huge success. I think, you know, it was super entertaining and got a lot of viewership. So hopefully they'll keep doing it, keep doing a good job with it. Okay, well, we got some questions here that kind of going into the Q&A portion of the show. And, of course, we got one from Ahmed N, as always. He says, I know this might sound nuts, but as a free-to-play player, there are aspects that paying players don't experience, like what cards to craft and how to manage with limited resources. Creating budget zoo is to target pirate and quest rogue is what I play right now. Not exploring the quests might be a lot down, but a lot worse. But I don't care as I read the meta and win. Okay, so
this guy knows what's up. Yeah.
So I guess his point is, you know, whenever you have the ability to net deck, you know, you might not understand, I guess, the same type of... you might not understand the scope of the cards that are actually available and how they can, you know, solve a problem in the most simplest way, I guess is how you look at it. So, you know, when you're looking at Pirate Warrior, okay, what is, you know, given my resources, what is the most, you know, very, very, you know, witty way or very smart way of dealing with super aggro and not having, you know, just all of these amazing taunts that you can get that are, you know, epic or legendary. What do you think about that? Do you think he has a point there?
I think a lot of people, and I think this is especially true in Goro, right? Like, more so than anywhere else, where, you know, net decking with the amount of decks that exist is extremely costly. There's so many decks. Like, you can't just decide, oh, I want to play this deck today, that deck tomorrow, if you don't have all the cards. And he's got a point. The point being that tailoring your own deck building to what you like and what you're facing is probably more accurate. But at the end of the day, there's a reason net decking exists and why it's so common. And that is not because people are idiots. It's because the decks that are typically rank one legend tend to be pretty good, and crafting the cards within it is likely to give you a high win rate, regardless of how you feel. Sometimes, even though you have a bad matchup against Pirate Warrior, the right answer is not to play Galaka Crawler. The right answer is to simply lose to Pirate Warrior and keep moving on and face other matchups. And the idea of teching and crafting to tech is, I think, somewhat erroneous unless you're specifically building to target that. And that's more true in tournaments than ladder. So reading the meta on ladder right now, like, I don't know how anybody does that. I'll be honest with you. I appreciate the thought, and maybe that's true at lower ranks, but where I'm standing at rank three, which is like the mid ranks, there's a meta-ish, but not really. Like, I won't start putting Hungry Crab in my Hunter because Murloc Paladin. Not yet, at least. And I like the concept, but I'm not sure.
Well, it's a very balanced meta right now. It's kind of what you're getting at least in this, you know, rank three area. And that's when it can be hard. There's always a meta, though. You know, whether it's just like 1% difference a 10% difference, there's always a meta. And things like, you know, what you know, just the meta reports that we see, you know, and just the analytics tools that we have out there can help with that. But to his point, though, reading the meta and countering the meta is the most efficient way to climb. And sometimes it doesn't take the best cards to actually counter the meta. You know, it could be a difference.
I'll give a good example of what I think is a proper tech and what is not a proper tech. I think Stampede and Kodo is a fantastic tech. Freeze Mage is in the meta. That kills Doomsayers when they come out on your board and try to wipe you out, which is why I think Kodo should be in the Murloc list. Stampede and Kodo is great because it kills Taunts and Taunt Warrior. It kills small minions and aggro decks. It kills mid-range minions and Totems and Shaman. It'll kill stuff like Radiant Elemental and Priest. It finds stuff to kill across the board.
Yeah.
But something as specific as Golok at Crawler, like the craft, we're talking 100 dust. It's a rare. Mm-hmm. You're putting 100 dust towards a tech card. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about it, especially in a non-Hunter deck. But I understand the reasoning, but I just don't know.
Yeah, it's not necessarily
compare both.
It might not be like Golok a Crawler so much, but it could be something like, you know, playing up that 1-2 poisonous minion, you know, versus, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you play something that actually deal. You know, you can't afford a Black Knight or something, so you play poisonous minions. You know, you're solving problems with the cards at hand. They just might not be the most efficient cards, but they still solve it enough that you can have success. And to his point, you do understand the game as a whole more when you do, I think, when you do play as a free-to-play player.
I'd agree with that. Mm-hmm. I think the fastest way to not get anything is just buy all the cards, net deck, and play.
That's right.
I've seen so many people just play a deck to horrible results, despite the fact that you remember those people we used to call the wallet warriors with just control warriors, and they just butchered acolyte plays and drew themselves to fatigue? Yeah, you know, don't be that guy. Don't be that guy. Just don't.
All right, Spooky. Next up, what are your opinions on Dirty Rat? This is kind of what I mentioned before. It can take out a Sorcerer's Apprentice or Antonidas from Exodia Mage, and the Mage can't do anything to win the game. It can pretty much win the games against combo decks and seems disruptive, like discarding cards from your opponent, which they said they won't make. It's also RNG. So I think he's talking about in terms of it being a negative thing. Do you think that Dirty Rat is a negative thing?
I think Dirty Rat is... So I like disruption as much as the next guy, but I absolutely loathe the RNG of Dirty Rat. I hate that sometimes the correct play is not to play Dirty Rat, and they play and they don't get punished when I have a punish in my hand. Like, I have five big minions and one small one, and they just pull out the small one. I hate the Dirty Rat when it's used offensively as either bringing out an Acidic Swamp Ooze or Reno Jackson. You know, like, the discrepancy in effect at the end of the game is massive. Or Kazakus, hey, good job, you did it. Or it brings out Doomsayer, which completely ruins the guy's Dirty Rat. Or shuts down a combo for removal you plan to do later. Anyway, point is, I like the effect of, hey, we're disrupting you. I don't mind that. It doesn't quite work like a discard, though. And there is some skill to using it. And for that reason, I don't mind it as much. It's not aggravating to me the way that, say, a Warlock self-discarding with, you know, Soulfire nailing every possible discard outlet fares. You know, I don't mind that. We need combo hatred that isn't Lotheb. That's how I feel. And I think Dirty Rat kind of does that.
Yeah. I still like Dirty Rat. I don't have that much problems with the RNG aspect of it, just because, you know, it's generally... I mean, it's risky for them to do it, but it's not risky in a way where, I guess, how do I put it? Yeah, you can get like an ooze sometimes, or you can, you know, get, have a rag, whatever, rag come out or something huge come out like that. But, you know, they know that going into that play, you know, and it's not usually like game losing at that moment either. It's just really bad for you, you know, generally, if he gets the right value card out from you. But, you know, it doesn't have that crazy impact that some of these other RNG cards have had in the past.
In Wild, for instance, right, like the control warrior build, some people are still running the whole Shield Maiden shenanigans with, you know, just play Elise, Golden Monkey.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things where Dirty Rat and Gold and the old Elise, or even the new Elise, you know, like we're in a value matchup. Let's assume it came down to that. And you pull my Elise and I can't get a pack in my deck.
Yeah.
Like in a value matchup, this might be ball breaking. Like it's just one of those things where I hate that my result is not guaranteed to be as good as yours. And so we're playing to see who gets the best Dirty Rat. It's like the old control wire mirrors where who draws their acolytes first and has a full hand, has to jam them on the board and loses. Who has to dump their hand? Who gets the best Golden Monkey? Right. Dirty Rat can feel that way. But when the metagame is very diverse, it oftentimes doesn't come to that. Like mirror matches are less frequent. So
yeah.
Dirty Rat becomes a tech against specific things like, hey, Quest Rogue, you bounce back that novice to your hand because you thought, hey, I'll play it next turn. Nope, you're not. And suddenly they're shut down. And in that way, I kind of like. So
Dirty Rat's one of those cards that it brings up another point, which we can, I think, maybe piggyback off of this. But Dirty Rat's a kind of card where I wish we could only play one. But it shouldn't be a legendary, though, you know, and we run into that type of, I think we run into those type of cards. We're starting to see it, like Dinomancy, for instance. That card, they didn't want to make a legend, but there's no reason why there's even the ability to have two of them.
I think most people who play two, and they do better with two.
Just for a higher chance of getting it?
Yeah, it's the consistency of it. Plus, sometimes you also get to refresh. I mean, it sounds stupid, but you can go kind of like Shadow Form, like Hero Power.
That's true. I guess you can do it twice.
You can double buff. Yeah. It's like, it's not amazing. I'll grant you that much. Mm. And I wish, by the way, the Dynomancy, when you played the second one, gave you a Shadow Form-ish effect where it became plus three.
Yeah.
I would have personally loved that, but I think they were erring on the side of caution with it. As opposed to...
it'd be balanced. I think it'd be fine, actually.
I think it would be fine, personally, but, you know, they're afraid of... So here's the deal, right? Shadow Form costs you three and pings for two, and then pings for three. This keeps a 3/3 on the board forever, or that +2/+2 forever. Like, it's never going away. And the permanence of it is the reason why Blizzard, I think, is very wary of letting it stick.
Yeah. But in general, though, they always have that limitation. You know, it's like they have to determine, like, okay, is this card a kind of card we want them to be able to play two of? And then at the same time, it's like, okay, do we want to actually make it legendary from the rarity standpoint? Because that's the only way we can not make it two of. So they have that limitation that's artificial in a way. Like, they don't have to do that if they didn't want to. I don't know how, you know, the best way to implement that, you know, just to have it be very accessible and people understand it. But it is a parameter that they work under in design. It limits them, too. I think it hurts.
It has to.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are some legendaries that probably shouldn't be legendaries, but they wanted to do them just because there's only one of them. So it throws things off, you know, sometimes whenever you do that. But anyway, generally, I think, you know, I don't have a problem with Dirty Rat and... I would like it if it was maybe just one, but two, there's not that many scenarios where it's terrible, for me at least. Let's see. Okay, Greek Geek 87. So he's from... we're taking your question from chat, buddy, given that you've asked it a lot of times. What do you think about Blizzard creating new archetypes each expansion instead of building upon previous ones, instead of just abandoning each archetype after each expansion? So examples of that, guys, would be Jade. Another example would be, what's another one? I mean, even just the Grimy Goons hand buffing.
Kazak is duplicates, Reno stuff. Like, that's another archetype. Reno. Or even Pirates. You know, Pirates got nothing new. Like, we're talking about, you know, abandoned archetypes.
Inspire.
Mex.
Yeah, I mean.
Mex, Inspire. Mm-hmm. And that's a really good question. Because I've been thinking a lot about this, a lot, and I, you know, they say, we've talked about this, I feel, on the show before, you know, Year of the Mammoth, Year of the Kraken. Okay, cool. We got a giant mastodon, and we got the whatever kraken is named.
A ton of beasts. Come on, we got a ton of beasts.
No. Listen, what my point is: what is the mammoth?
Oh,
what does it have anything to do with? And like, I wish every expansion during the year of the mammoth had a big ass legendary mammoth. You know, that did something. I mean, like old god style. Like if it was called Year of the Old Gods, you would have one old god per set. I'm exaggerating a bit because that's very specific. But I think it would be nice to have a unifying theme running throughout the entire theme of the year. As opposed to, you know, kind of a fire and forget, pick an animal, go. I really would like that to be the case. And one of the cool things is it allows them to pace the release of certain cards for certain archetypes, right? Like they already do that where they say, oh, let's release tall wire stuff in whatever the expansion was, Karazhan and the one before that with Bolster. All right, guys, now let's, like sparring partner, let's release something for tall wire, something for tall wire. You know what? This isn't working. Let's brute force it. Quest. And now next time it might be another archetype they've been kind of implementing stuff for. And now they could go, all right, guys, we're pushing that one now. And have it be themed around an entire block of sets like Magic does it, as opposed to, you know, put that mechanic in one expansion and forget about it. That's one of the things I would
agree like. Too. And I feel like they're going to try to get to that. It was, you know, the planning of this, and I think decisions made with even standard and resets and things like that were probably made in parallel, not necessarily in tandem with, you know, just some of the design, right? Because these designs, you know, they said it, right? 8 months in advance or something like that. Sometimes these decisions for what to do with releases like are made separately. So I think now that they kind of have these things in, you know, just in play, and now they have like 8 months since the last time we've done, you know, like they've definitely had plenty of time since the first time they've done it. I think they can probably group these a little bit better. So like, I guess Year of the Mammoth, like to your point, we've had a lot of beasts, at least, right? And hopefully the beasts continue.
Yeah, sure.
But they've added so many beasts that it's just like, are you seriously going to add more beasts in the next few expansions?
It's not the beasts I want. It's not even the beasts I want. It's just one unifying.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
You know, like if they make it Year of the Fish, I want to see Nat Bagel the Dark Fisher. I want to see Nat Bagel the Light Fisher. And I want to see Nat Bagel the Neutral Fisher. Like, I don't care what these guys are, but I want to see something that has to do with the theme of the.
You know what's funny is the Year of the Mammoth. The only mammoth I think we have right now. Well, actually, except
it's
for
giant
the
mastodon. It's not even a mammoth.
Yeah, we have a behemoth too, but he's jade.
Oh God, run away!
Yeah, but I see your point. I definitely see your point. But overall, I think that as long as they cluster whatever they do into the three releases per year, then the resets won't be. The resets will just, I guess, remove these things so that you don't have any half-made type of archetypes still existing. An example would be like Dragon, for instance. Like Dragon is like half-baked right now, and sure, they can go and sub some more, but you're always going to be off. You're going to be all offset by half a set like every single time right now, right? So, you know, next release, you're going to lose Operative and Historian and all, you know, just all the cards that actually are still pretty good. So they have to eventually fix that, you know, or at least align a lot of those together. But overall, yeah, I wish they would. At least for the given year, for the three expansions, they need to continue themes on, and then, you know, have the reset, just have all those themes go away, and then they come in with a new set. But expansion with their individual themes, I think that's where they can fall into the trap. Because, I mean, what if the next one is, I don't know, like a mech one, like a GVG type of theme or something like that? Then all of a sudden they're going to come out with all these new mechs. Like, it'd be kind of weird.
A mechanical mammoth. I demand
a mechanical mammoth.
I demand a mechanical mammoth.
Is it a beast
mammoth,
or is it a mech? Can we have two tribes now?
Yeah, go, dude. Make it a beast mech. I'm down.
Beast
for that. I mean, the point, and I'm sure at some point we'll have double tribes. There's got to be a point where something's going to be like both a beast and a pirate or something. It's going to be called Scratches, and it's going to be a cat or whatever. Yeah. But Scratches the cat. Don't make it come out of the cannon. Don't.
Yeah.
But,
I guess
we're going to get that.
I guess another way to put it is design, or like from a thematic, you know, art wise and thematic standpoint, you know, when you're creating each year, like look at it from the standpoint of each year and then lay those out. You don't have to design the cards, just design the themes like beforehand for each year. And then, you know, thematically, hopefully they'll have some synergy, and then they'll feel like, you know, sets each year versus what we have right now, which is sets every expansion, which hasn't worked so far. Yeah. I hope they don't make any more Jade cards, just putting that out there.
I mean, please.
They said they weren't going to do anything else with the Ajazan, but, I wouldn't mind if they did some more Kazakus or just Cabal type of things. That would be okay with me. I'd be completely fine with that.
I don't mind the no duplicates. The thing is, like, there's so few cards in a set that they have to be cautious of not taking too many slots for that, which is why, again, I will propose that they add cards in between sets as punctual thematic releases.
Okay.
I think that could be another way to, you know, weave in. You know, do you want to put Mammoths in your Un'Goro? I get it. You know, that's fine. You don't want to put it into your, you know, mean evil streets of Get It Sand number 2 hashtag episode second, like, of the next expansion we're getting. I don't mind it. That's fine. You don't have to. But I would at the very least like, you know, every 2 weeks a new card that has to do with the year of the mammoth in some way.
Yeah.
That would be nice.
I think that'd be fair. Because it could almost even be Volcanosaur-like. Just give it to us.
Yeah, sure.
You know, in some way. And it doesn't even have to be super good. It just has to be marginally good.
A thematic card. I don't care if it's garbage, as long as it's at least funny. It's like those promo Gelbin type cards. That's what I want. I want more promo Gelbin type cards that people play for memes or fun or just have it for free because they were there. You know, that it's all right. That's fine by me.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Well, I think that's going to be it, guys. That's, I think we're out of topics, and it's been an hour and a half. So Noxious, great show. Got any shout outs you want to do?
Well, big shout out to Complexity as usual, but shout out to you for the Streamer Showdown put together with Colin. You ended up working out.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for hosting
really
it. Of course.
I feel like this week was really good for just in general the whole Chanman endeavors. It's been a good week.
Yeah, I still got two more shows tomorrow. So
you're not done.
It's
man.
A busy week, of course. And you're going to be streaming, right, rest of the week, right?
Not after this, but at some point tomorrow, probably. Yeah,
okay.
I'm not casting Starladder, so I'll be indeed streaming.
Awesome. Sounds good. And thank you, of course, for doing the show today, as well as hosting this yesterday. It was amazing. Amazing at just, you know, all the plugs and just, you know, just able to, I don't know, keep it entertaining with all the players too. It's definitely an art. It's definitely a skill that not everybody has. So, you know, definitely fantastic job on that, buddy. And I want to thank all the patrons, of course, that support the show at patreon.com/valiantown. And again, also Ting for sponsoring this episode. And for those of you that, you know, are looking for a cell phone provider that might fit your needs in terms of you know, how you use data and how you use text messaging, especially if you're somebody who's always around Wi-Fi, Ting is like the best solution for you, because of course you're not using data during that time and you're probably overpaying by a lot for data, and Ting is like perfect for that. So go check out valuetown.ting.com, and they have like a little tool that checks to see if your phone is compatible with them. They use the T-Mobile and Sprint networks, but they also include like a lot of the phones from all the other providers too. So go ahead and check that out and see if you can. And there's also a promo that's for $25, and for the average Ting phone bill it's actually $23, so you're basically getting like a free month whenever you do sign up. They've got great customer support, award-winning. You know, you're going to be talking to somebody when you call if you ever have a problem. So you can't really say that for a lot of the other cell phone providers out there. Anyways, check them out. They're supporting, you know, this show, and it looks like they're going to be trying to support some more stuff in Hearthstone too. So
that's fantastic.
Just give them just some support if you can. But that's going to be it, guys, for Valuetown this week. So for Noxious and myself, Chanman V, we'll see you next week. Oh, follow the Twitter channel, ValueTownGG.